No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from Washington, D.C., America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to us, important to all of us. And today we're lucky enough to have with us Matt Dixon. Matt is a senior national politics reporter for NBC News and a former Florida bureau chief for Politico. Dixon has played a key role in NBC News' 2024 presidential election coverage and has lived in the Sunshine State, where he moved immediately after college in beautiful but cold Wisconsin. So we're so happy to have him on the show. Matt, thanks for being on.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start at the beginning. You've just written, you've just published a book. I take it that you wrote it a while ago about DeSantis and Donald Trump, called Swamp Monsters. I can't think of a more appropriate title for a book about these two guys that spend a lot of time in Florida. So tell us about the book. That's the first thing. Tell us about the
book. Yeah, sure. Well, I spent really the past 3 years doing it. We wanted to, originally, that's a longer runway for a book than normal, but we wanted to capture all of the 2022 midterms and going into the early part of the 2024 election cycle. And I'm glad we did, because the narrative went from, you know, Ron DeSantis as America's governor. He had won re-election here in Florida by 20 points, this historic sort of margin. And then it ended very quickly, you know, 7-8 months later with him, you know, his poll numbers collapsing and the picture changed quite a bit. So as folks will see, Swamp Monsters, when if they look at the cover, it features Trump and DeSantis. So those are sort of the main characters, obviously. They've had the relationship that's helped really define, you know, modern politics, especially on the Republican side. But we get into a lot of layers. There's Florida-specific stuff, national 2024. We get into sort of the collapse of the Democrats here in the state, which really helped, you know, aid the rise of DeSantis and Trump. So there's a bunch of layers to the book, but the main through line is sort of the evolution of the relationship between those two guys that we've all been talking about for a while now.
Well, since you brought it up, and this is a very important issue to me, it's something that I've been talking about for years, and I feel like I'm screaming into the void. But let's talk about the collapse of the Democratic Party for a minute in Florida, okay? Because I think, unfortunately, the Democrats don't get it. I'm a loyal Democrat, and I remember going right after Trump was elected, going to a thing where I spoke, and a woman stood up in the audience and said, as Democrats, we have nothing to be sorry about. You know, we didn't do anything wrong. And my reaction to that was, of course we did something wrong. If we didn't do something wrong, this crazy guy wouldn't have gotten elected. So what do you think? You have any insights on what the Democrats are doing wrong? Is there any lessons to be learned from what happened in Florida?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, depending on how far you want to go back, I mean, I think a lot of it starts at the state level when they started to lose control of the legislature. They haven't elected a governor here since the late 1990s. So what there's really been a funding disparity for a long time now. So, you know, the sort of transactional donors that, you know, need the party in power and need those decision makers in Tallahassee, the state capital, and other elements of state government really have no incentive to give to Democrats right now. And that was exacerbated when sort of the constellation of national Democratic committees, you know, DTRIP, DS, those sort of organizations decided that, hey, Florida's got 10 really, really expensive media markets. It costs a lot to be on TV, and it's a TV state. And of the past few election cycles, especially the 2022 midterms, they decided that, hey, you know, why don't we spend money in Arizona, Georgia, North Carolina, states that are trending our way, and we get a lot bigger ROI. We don't have to spend as much money, and we can win races there. So I think it's been a decades-long process, quite literally 25 years or so. And I think the latest turn and really what's hurt the party here recently is sort of being abandoned by national Democrats who are seeing, one, Florida, you know, doesn't need to be, you know, they don't need to win Florida to get the White House anymore. And two, there's other states that are cheaper and they can win races there.
Yeah, they've given up Florida for dead, right? You know, sure. There's no way we can win there. And state parties have always been a problem with the Democratic Party. I used to be in charge of the DNC's program to raise money for state parties. And the state parties disliked us so much in those days that we would call and we would say, hey, we're going to raise money for you. And they'd say, no, thanks. And we'd say, what? We'd say, what? No, no, no. We're going to come into your state. And we're going to raise money. And they're like, no, we don't want anything to do with you people. And we're like, but we're the National Democratic Party. And they're like, we don't care. You don't understand. It's free money. We don't care. You know, it just blew me away when I was there. But yeah, that's always a problem. And, you know, to wrestle control, just for our listeners, one of the things we did to try to wrestle control from the state parties when I was there was we created a superdelegate. I've been a superdelegate to the last three conventions, and I assume I'll be a superdelegate this time as well. But we created the superdelegate so that we would be in control. You know, if things weren't going our way, we could inject all these superdelegates, and there's over 1,000 of us, into the process and make sure that the incumbent always got the nomination. So it's been a struggle for a very long time, but that's a good thing to know. Let me ask you, what about Nikki Haley? What does Nikki Haley do now? She says she's staying in the race. We see these polls, these nationwide polls that show that she's ahead of Biden in some critical places. There's a recent VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University poll that shows her 5 points ahead of Biden in Virginia, a must-win state for him. But yet, in South Carolina, her home state, the latest poll showed her 35 points down to Trump. Can she stay in? Go ahead.
Well, I mean, there's a key difference between her and what just happened to DeSantis. DeSantis is completely out of money. So, I mean, I think his team would have loved to try to stand at least through South Carolina, especially after Haley, you know, didn't win in New Hampshire. But they just couldn't afford to. With Nikki Haley, she's still raising quite a bit of money. They just announced, I think, another $2 million plus in hard money that they had brought in for the campaign. So she's got an interesting decision to make. I don't think she's, you know, got a lot of winnable states out there. I think pretty much everyone has come to the conclusion that the Republican primary is over in a lot of ways, with you know, Trump lining up, you know, two big victories right away, and there's likely more to come, and he has, you know, huge leads in most public polling. But the one thing she has going for her, if she wants to stay in and do delicate acquisition mode or just kind of continue to go forward to stay part of it, is she's got money where Ron DeSantis did not. And so it'll be interesting to see. And I'm not totally sure her thought process on that. Everything she's projected is that she wants to stay in the race. But, you know, presidential campaigns are going to stay in the race for the long haul until they don't. And we just saw that with DeSantis. So the fact that she could fuel herself for a while is a wrinkle in a dynamic that I think is fascinating to watch. But do I think it's going to really make any difference? I'm in agreement with most people that I think the Republican primary is largely over at this point.
Yeah. And if she loses South Carolina, I mean, oh my God, right? She was governor and I mean, I think the money starts to really dry up if that happens. But let me ask you about DeSantis again for a minute. My opinion is he made a really good move. It may be the only – he had so many bad moves in his campaign. It may be the only good move he made, because now, you know, if Trump wins the nomination and wins the presidency, then he's timed out at the end of his presidency. He can't run again. Same thing goes for Biden. So no matter who wins, if it's a Biden-Trump election, there will be no incumbent in 2028. And DeSantis, as a Republican, can A, say that he was a loyalist, right, because he stood behind Trump, won't he be the heir apparent for the Republican nomination? Doesn't he stand in good stead?
Well, I think there's two schools of thought on that. I mean, one, because he endorsed so quickly, as he was getting out, he endorsed Trump. So there might be those who say, yeah, absolutely, he's going to try to get back in the good graces. But I do think there's a lot of Trump supporters, and we interviewed many of them, who keep going back to this idea that even with that, there's a sort of a disloyalty factor that is sort of baked into the Trump DNA right now. They endorsed DeSantis in 2018 when he ran for governor, and it made a huge difference to help him become governor. So when DeSantis made it clear in 2022, when he was rising nationally, that he wanted to run for president, and it was clear that's the signal he was sending, there was a huge moment with Trump, who just, you know, kind of viewed him as disloyal and not someone to be trusted, and that was really a key break in their relationship. So DeSantis, and now DeSantis, after he got out, there was initially seemed to be kind of a sense of an olive branch being extended. DeSantis endorsed Trump. Trump, in turn, for the first time in months, didn't criticize him. I believe he said he ran a good race, or I don't have the comment in front of me. But Trump seemed to leave the door open for moving forward, more aligned. But then DeSantis very quickly, via X or Twitter, put out a post that sort of he was threatening to veto a bill in Florida that would have paid Trump's legal bills. It was a state-level piece of legislation in Florida that would set aside $5 million that could have been used to pay Trump's legal bills. It was put forward by some state-level supporters of Trump. So that bill essentially has been pulled now because DeSantis said he would veto it, which really, really angered some Trump supporters that thought it was unnecessary and unneeded, and DeSantis didn't need to do it in that moment. So the idea that he is in good graces with Trump, and I think the Trump Republican base, I don't know is the case at the moment, though there is a lot of time to fix that. I don't know that he's in great standing as we chat here today.
Well, what if Trump runs and loses? Doesn't that help DeSantis? Doesn't it?
Yeah, sure.
Or get rid of some of this. I mean, I've never seen any loyalty like we see now with Trump. I mean, these guys are almost cult-like, right? You can't do anything. People that they've been loyal to for years, people that have been elected and reelected and reelected, like Romney, these people hate him because he disagrees with Donald Trump. I've never seen any kind of cult-like adherence to a political candidate. So, but if Trump loses, do these guys start to get the message?
Well, that's yet to be seen. If Trump loses, and I mean, it's important to remember, pre-2022 and even early in the midterms, he wasn't the vocal. He wasn't out, giving speeches or posting on social media necessarily every day. He wasn't as big a part of the party. He didn't really re-engage until early 2023 when he was looking to run for president again. So it all depends. I mean, if Trump stays engaged and even if he loses, continues to, very much publicly try to get attention and try to get headlines, I think that the intensity of his supporters are going to stay with him, and it's going to continue to be a problem for anyone else who wants to potentially fill the void moving forward. Now, Ron DeSantis has not gotten close to the level of scorn that folks like Mitt Romney have gotten and a few others, because he hasn't gone full anti-Trump. And I think he does have an opportunity, if we're talking about him running in 2028, to fix his relationship with Republican primary voters. I think he's got two or three legislative sessions, 2 or 3 years left in Florida to pass bills and sort of rebuild his brand and rebuild his image with those voters. But I'm just, as the moment stands here today, I don't know that he's a card carrying, member in good standing of America First yet, because I think on the way out, he vetoed a bill that, would have paid Trump's legal fees, and that pissed off a lot of people in Trump's orbit. So it could all be, in the rearview mirror in the next year or two. But right now, I'm just not sure it is.
Well, and we all know that if Donald Trump loses, he'll just be a nice guy and go away and not say anything, right? I mean, there's only that Donald Trump will never go away. I mean, I'm not even sure if he passes away, he'll go away. He really has made an indelible mark on American politics. What do you think about the latest? Let's forget the 91 court cases. But what about senators coming out now against him for telling them to can the border deal so that he can make political hay with it?
That's certainly a new interesting dynamic. I mean, he's flexing even though he's out of office and sort of, you know, right. McConnell's obviously still behind it, but he's a divisive, powerful figure. And I mean, obviously immigration is not only one of the key issues in 2024, it's quickly and understandably so becoming, you know, one of the primary issues that both sides are talking about. So Trump has really had a big time presence already. He's a big time cloud over conversation on that bill. And his power once again is showing up in very clear ways. And I know there are some people arguing that they just want nothing to pass and sort of chaos to remain throughout the cycle because it's such a politically important and toxic issue. And I think there's that argument makes sense if you frame it the right way. But I think more than anything else, it just shows even out of office before he's even officially the nominee, just the power that he continues to wield.
And you'd never find a Democrat doing that. I mean, I'm not saying that a Democrat wouldn't try to use that kind of influence. I'm just saying a Democrat would make sure he didn't get caught doing it. What I mean? I mean, it's not that we're better. It's just that, we understand it. It's just the optics of it are horrible.
Yeah, well, I also don't think Democrat or any other Republican politician, this is a uniquely Donald Trump position because of the intensity of support that you just talked about. I mean, I'm not sure that any other politician could pull this off, quite honestly. Right. So I don't even know if it's a Democrat or Republican in the sense that, we don't ordinarily see presidential candidates operate this way. I think this is, beyond the partisan sort of parameters, and this is just a uniquely Trump dynamic.
Yeah. And we see a lot of that, don't we? And it really is reshaping politics. The first guy I ever worked for in politics was Jimmy Carter. Now, Jimmy Carter was not a great president, but he was a really good guy. To see this guy and to see the way the press is taken to him. Now, that's a really, really amazing thing. I was in Iowa in 2016 at the caucuses when he first ran, and I remember going to a Clinton event, and there were three TV cameras set up in the back of the room, and everything was like I would expect it to be at such an event. And then I went to a Trump event, and there were 30 TV cameras. They were everywhere. It's not only that the people love the controversy, the press loves the controversy too, don't they? It gives them something to write about.
I had 2016 was specifically unique because all this is so new. So I think some of the press criticism is valid, and I won't push back against all of it. But especially in 2015, when he first came on the scene, and he was just such a different thing to look at, it was, I think the press needed to adjust, and whether they have or have not enough, I think is still up for debate. But there was just such a newness to it during the 2016 cycle that, we had the live rally coverage and, more press for him than other candidates. So I think there was a lot there, but to your point, the chaos, this isn't just at national political reporting levels. I had an old editor at one of my first jobs in Little Panama City, Florida, Panama City News Herald, it was called. And there was a big bridge in town called the Hathaway Bridge. And he used to always remark, there's a thousand cars that go over the Hathaway Bridge every day. It's only news when one crashes. And that's always kind of stuck with me for my rest of my career, is sort of how, the world is sometimes viewed through the media lens.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And this guy, I was brought up in politics right out of college, just like you, I guess. And this guy violated all the rules. I mean, that's what really got it. You don't do anything to upset women. That's one of the cardinal rules of politics, right? Because more women vote than men. You don't argue with the press. I mean, and he, right, he makes fun of the press. He makes fun of women. I mean, he did everything that we were told you should never, ever, ever do in politics. And it's worked out for him. He's just changed the face of politics. Go ahead.
Well, another big thing politicians are never supposed to do is get indicted. There was a moment. Right. Not that long ago in politics, if you got indicted, it was a much, much bigger deal. And I think for some politicians, it probably still is. But, you know, he's got two federal and two state now. And I think it's going to be a vastly different conversation in the general election. But he got indicted four times and it's been nothing but rocket fuel and intensified his base. That's certainly not something that political rule books generally include a chapter on either.
Right. But unfortunately, not getting indicted was something that all of us, you know, many politicians forgot about. And I must say, as a student of politics, it's sometimes, I guess I find it amusing or interesting when they do get indicted, some of the things they say, you know, like, Senator Menendez, who doesn't have $10,000 in their pajamas? You know, right?
That's right.
What if you have to tip the paper boy? Where are you going to?
Yeah, we all tip our paper boy with gold bars.
Exactly. And you know, I was in at DNC when we had the big. This is probably before your time, but we had this scandal where these guys were taking their franking privilege. You know that.
Mm-hmm.
That sure. Congress
sure.
can mail for free, mm-hmm. and they were sure. taking the stamps and they were taking them back to the post office and getting refunds and keeping them. I don't know that everybody knows this, but you can take your unused postage stamps back to the post office and redeem them for 80% of their value. So, you know, these guys were going in, they were cashing. And my favorite was some politician from my home state of New Jersey who said, yes, he took the money, but he built a shrine to the Virgin Mary in his backyard. And the most beautiful thing about his explanation was they had a picture of it and you could tell the cement was still wet, you know, like he done it the night before, you know, and you almost got to admire him for having the guts to stand up before a TV camera and say something like that.
Sure.
But yeah, Trump is certainly, he's really changed the landscape. So, what do you think about the Democrat? I mean, it seems that the Republicans are on more solid footing right now in going forward with their campaign that America has a crime problem, that we're not safe. Whereas the Democrats seem to be going ahead with, you know, Trump is a threat to our democracy. Do you think
sure.
they have a stronger position?
Well, I think they've certainly message it better, and to some degree, crime is always going to move the needle politically.
Right.
I know there was just a round. Well, I don't necessarily cover the criminal justice statistics myself. I know there was just a round that indicated, you know, murder rates and some other crime statistics were actually down, despite the coverage and the blanket discussion about it. So I think they've done a very good job, you know, talking about it and framing it that way. And also, it needs to. I think can't be understated that right now the attention has largely been on a competitive Republican primary, and the Democrats and the Biden campaign, which did raise a ton of money, haven't really started communicating or really started campaigning yet in a real way. So I do kind of wonder if some of those elements are going to change, or at least be a little more clouded as far as it being cut and dry once the primary season, which we're kind of exiting now, really turns into general election season, and we have both sides, you know, really engaging in an intense way, as opposed to what we've seen over the past few months, is one party is working through a primary that Democrats didn't really have.
Yeah, well, and you know what? As you well know, it doesn't matter whether what you're saying is true or not. It just matters whether you can make people believe it. You know, you quoted your old editor. I'll quote my old boss who used to say, if you don't have a job, unemployment is 100%. Don't worry about the statistics, you know, worry
yeah,
about
right.
communicating with the individual, right?
Sure,
let me ask you, since you're in Florida, And there are a bunch of old people, we know, down in Florida. How much of Trump support do you think? I mean, I'm not looking for an actual number, but how much do you think racism plays in Trump support? How much do you think people are upset because on issues like immigration, because they're fearful? They think that, you know, when I was growing up, it was great to be a white guy, I can tell you. And do people fear because they're losing some of that power? Do you think that's what motivates them to be Trump supporters?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't. It's interesting way to frame it, but he won Florida when he won it in 2020 by roughly 3 points or so. It was considered a huge margin, and he won, or he did better with the South Florida Hispanic voters than Republicans historically had, and it kind of opened the door. Ron DeSantis in the 2022 midterms won Miami-Dade County, which has a collection of the, you know, some of the most Hispanic. It's one of the most Hispanic counties in the country. So to frame it kind of that cut and dry, I think is difficult, especially if you want to talk about immigration, because there are Republicans, including very much Trump and then DeSantis, who actually did well with those populations. There's certainly still Florida's Hispanic population gets a lot of discussion, but there's still it's very much a vast majority white state. So they obviously do well with those voters as well. But I don't know that it's as simple as that necessarily. I know that sometimes messages that, you know, that is a big part of Republicans' message when it comes to immigration and crime. But in Florida specifically, Republican candidates, including the ones we're talking about, have started to do better and sometimes win counties where there's a lot of Hispanic voters.
Well, and you know, that in part is a fault of the Democratic Party as well for not reaching out the way they should to both black and, you know, there's a lot of black voters now. I don't know about Hispanic voters, but there are a lot of black voters that feel that they've been taken for granted because they always vote Democratic. And there's been an element in the Democratic Party for years that talks about that. Says we shouldn't just give our vote to the Democrats because it hurts us in the end. And so
I feel like I've written a story almost every 2 years, every election cycle for a long time about how Democratic or left-leaning activists in you know, the Hispanic communities have put up, you know, sort of smoke signals or flags or red flares, whatever you want to say, about how Democrats, whomever it might be, a U.S. Senate candidate here, a presidential candidate here, how they've sort of neglected or haven't been in those neighborhoods, you know, doing the groundwork like they should be. It seems like I haven't focused always as much on other states like Texas or Arizona or other states with large Hispanic populations. But I know here in Florida, it's almost every election cycle, there's a gripe from the Democratic activists that's such a key segment of the population that sometimes Republicans put more resources into and do a better job of courting.
Well, you know, we suffer from this in Washington, D.C. We never get any candidates. We never get, because Washington is the slam dunk for the Democrats, right? We have no Democratic elected officials. We've never voted for a Democrat for president. I'm a Republican for president. We have no Republican elected officials. No, we've never voted for a Republican for president. We, you know, we're Democrat, Democrat, Democrat. And so they totally ignore us. When we go to the convention, and as I said, I'm a superdelegate, they sit us, we're looking at the back of the heads of the people from Guam and the Virgin Islands. I mean, they sit us in the rafters. You know, if you want to trade your credentials with somebody from California or something, and so that you can sit up front. But so we certainly feel that pain. And so, what do you think the Democrat? If they said, Matt, we're going to give you a job as chairman of the Democratic Committee, and you're going to be President Biden's campaign manager. Because I don't think people know, a lot of people know this, but as soon as you get the nomination, your campaign takes over the Democratic Committee or the Republican Committee. They're in charge. So if somebody said that to you, what advice would you give President Biden if you had to give him a piece of advice right now?
Well, that's certainly not a job I would take and what I'm not qualified for. But honestly, a lot of the things.
Or you're too smart, one of the two.
Yeah, well, a lot of the things we just talked about. I mean, honestly, some of the Florida-centered conversation we had, I wouldn't actually argue that the party should do anything different. The White House, the path to the White House for Democrats is through the Midwest now. It's not Florida. So, yeah. I mean, the one obvious thing that I would note is the leaving the state that I live in for dead probably isn't strategically a terrible idea. And I think they're aware of that.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's the truth, isn't it? And you know, they only concentrate on those states that are, you know, in port, what we call the sacred 11, right? I mean, do people realize, given the Electoral College, that you can lose 39 states and still get elected? I don't know that people really realize that, but you need the sacred 11, right? New York, California, Illinois, you know them all. And we tend to ignore everybody else, and it's recently raised its ugly head in Iowa. You know, we took the primary, the caucuses, away from Iowa because we wanted New Hampshire to be first, and you know, they make silly decisions, I think, all the time. But so what now, Matt? You've written a book about Trump and DeSantis. You're a national news person. What's next on the agenda for you?
Well, I mean, right now, you know, the day job certainly has me pretty busy with 2024, and I love covering this stuff. So that's my main focus right now. But we just finished. I'm just on the final stages of a month long book tour. So I guess the hope is to sell some books, and maybe at some point when the day job settles down, figure out a way to write another one, because I enjoyed the process, and it was a really sort of a satisfying, filling process. I've been writing most of my adult life, and all of my adult life, and it's just such a different way to do it that I enjoyed it. But for right now, I need to kind of settle in and make sure we're, you know, I'm doing what I need to do to make sure NBC's coverage is the best it can be for the 2024 cycle here.
Yeah, and I'm sure it is exciting. This is really a pivotal point in history, is it not? I mean, is it an exaggeration that the Democratic platform seems to be that this is a matter of saving our democracy? Do you think that's an exaggeration? If Trump gets elected, do you think we lose our democracy?
Yeah, I think I certainly think that's the platform of Democrats, and that's, you know, really what, once I think we had talked about how, you know, Biden and the Democratic constellation of organizations around him have raised, I think their first number is almost $100 million. Really, they've raised a lot of money. And once they really start to engage in a real way, I think it's going to be a lot of that. I'm certain if the you know, the economy continues to incrementally improve, there's going to be some focus on that, because the economy is always sort of the lifeblood of politics. But I think with Trump specifically, especially since, you know, he's, you know, been the nominee, or likely to be the nominee, three times. He's a former incumbent president. He's only got 51% in Iowa, roughly 54% in New Hampshire. I think there's, you know, Democrats are probably going to see an opportunity where once they get to the general election, there's, you know, that message is going to resonate with both, you know, Democrats and to their hope independents and ever Trump Republicans. And I think they're going to try to thread that needle when things really get going in earnest here.
Well, you know, I pass this on to you to keep in mind as you cover things. You know, there's a Chinese curse, which is, may you be born in interesting times. And I think we're certainly in interesting times right now. And it must be an amazing, you must be in an amazing position to cover this stuff. I eat it up. Much to the chagrin of my wife, I read it every morning and get up angry about it and get my blood pressure up and you know. Anyway, as we move forward here, and assuming that we get rid of Haley, which seems inevitable, what about the great... What do you think happens to the conflict between Trump and Biden? Do they change directions at all, or do they just go at it the way, you know, from, you know, immigration on the one hand and democracy on the other? Is that what the battle becomes?
Well, I don't think this, you know, sometimes campaigns with lesser known candidates will start out with sort of the softer biographical ads to introduce themselves to voters and sort of frame their own messaging. I think the soft biographical portion with these two, because they're so well known and know how to run each other, run against each other, is going to kind of go out the window, and it's going to be knives out from the go if they aren't already. I mean, I don't think, you know, we're obviously not officially in general election season yet, so I don't think it's as intense as it's going to get. But I think these two, both sides, know how to run against each other. They, you know where their weaknesses are. They know how they want to message against each other. And I think that's going to start from, you know, if it's not starting already, that's going to start from day one of the general election. And it is going to be a somewhat toxic 6-7 months here as we hash all this out going into November.
Well, and please, since you've written a book on Donald Trump, please explain to me, if you can, as a kid that grew up with no money, ended up being a Teamster, how does this guy convince working class people that he knows their pain? The guy's never worked a day in his life. You know, I told the Washington Post one time when they interviewed me, I said, I've done exactly what Donald Trump's done. And they said, how's that? And I said, I've taken the fortune that my father left me, and I've, you know, increased it 1,000-fold. I said, the only difference is my father left me $50. You know, therein lies the difference, right? So how does this guy that was, you know, whose father gave him $100 million, but $100 million meant something, how does he convince working class people, union people? I see that Joe Biden just got the UAW.
Joe Biden just picked that up. Yeah.
Yeah. But how does he convince working class people that he knows their pain, that he, I mean, I just find that incredible.
Yeah. It's been what I think one of the most studied and reported on dynamics of the Trump era, certainly post 2015, 2016. And I'm not sure that I have any gleaming insights that have already not been put out there on this specifically, but I think there are two things. I mean, his language and how he spoke as a presidential candidate, I think, was vastly different than most. And I think some people honed in on the idea that, you know, the part of the electorate we're talking about is felt abandoned at times and just, you know, wasn't being talked to. And some of that, you know, Trump really brought those folks out in heavy ways. And there are, you know, others who just, you know, weren't even voting that I think Trump, I don't have the low propensity voter numbers in front of me, but I think, you know, Trump had a knack, especially in 2016, to really sort of tap into those folks. And I think after 2016 happened and after his first term in office, the die had sort of been set for the intensity, his support moving forward into, you know, his reelection, which obviously didn't go on the general election, but the 2020 and now 2022, I think, has, you know, been domino cycles off of 2016 once he was able to really build that intense support base and certainly only, you know, intensify it during his 4 years in office.
Well, you know, I think the most horrible thing he's ever said, And this is hard because he said many horrible things, is that I am your retribution. You know, that's a campaign slogan. I am your retribution. Do you think most of his supporters want to get even? They want to get even with us liberals who have talked down to them in years and made them feel, you know, if they're not a feminist, you're a loser. And if you're not college educated, you're a bozo. And is it a reaction to that?
I don't think it's specifically even liberals anymore. The general idea of what would have been considered sort of a more Chamber of Commerce Republican, the sort of, you know, blue blazers and boat shoes cut that had defined the party before Trump, the, you know, you'd mentioned Mitt Romney, like, I think, and now Nikki Haley has sort of become the embodiment of that in the moment as the, you know, the candidate for that crowd. So I don't even think that those commentary are directed specifically at Democrats anymore. It's just sort of anyone that's outside of the MAGA or America First, whatever, you know, whatever you want to call it, that movement. And he also regularly says, and I've seen it a you know, many of the rallies, almost every rally I think I've covered of Trump, of the idea that, you know, they, and it's kind of ill-defined, that they are coming after you. I just happen to be standing in the way. And it's sort of the, you know, the victim, we're always under attack sort of dynamic that he sets up. And that line, I mean, I've heard it many times from the former president, always gets a huge applause at rallies and events that he's at. So I think he set up that dynamic very, very well. And it's clearly, you know, to the portion of the electorate that he's talking to, it's worked very well.
And have you covered a rally where the press has been attacked? I mean, he seems to attack the press a lot. And yeah. And have you been at a rally where you've ever felt endangered or, you know, anything like that? When he stands up and he says, turn around and look at those guys in the back. They suck. You know, I mean.
I've certainly been at rallies. I've never been in a rally where member of the media has been attacked or there hasn't been any sort of, you know, moment of aggression. But certainly when you're in the press pen in the back of the room and there's, you know, thousands of people in the room and he, you know, points and says, you know, those are the enemy of the people. It's, right. It, you know, can be a nerve wracking moment because you do get the sense if he were to, you know, if he were to say go, that they would go. And that's never a thing that's happened. And I've never truly felt really that unsafe, but they're unsettling moments when, you know, all of the eyes of people who probably openly would say they don't like you are kind of giving you the side eye in the back of the room. And there's a lot of side eyes looking back at you.
Well, given his ability to get people to go attack the capital of the United States, I think I'd be, you know, I'd be a little scared if I was in the back, especially, you know, it's funny. I went to the Republican convention, not the last one because they were virtual, but the one before. And there were literally hundreds and hundreds of people in the crowd with sidearms. There yeah. were so many police officers at the Cleveland convention, and you could tell they were on edge. They were just, you know, they hated the fact that all these guys were walking around with guns, you know.
Sure.
And I never seen security like that. And there was a decision just prior to the convention that they were allowed to carry. If you had a carry permit, you could carry your gun. So, yeah, I think I would have worried. I think you're maybe braver than I am.
I've never, like I said, I've never seen any. I've been to a bunch of Trump rallies at this point. I've never actually seen any violence or anything at them. So I'm sure there's examples that other reporters or other people at rallies might be able to point to that events that I personally was not at, but I've never personally seen anything like that at rallies that I've covered.
Is there any chance, is there any hope in the world for Nikki Haley that she could leave the Republican Party and run as an independent?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think independent stuff is a bit of pipe dreams. I certainly, if I was, you know, an anti Trump person or someone who didn't support the former president, I don't know that I would put much hope in that idea. I know with No Labels and other organizations, there's been a more intensified conversation about that sort of dynamic this cycle, but it seems, you know, so incredibly unlikely that I certainly don't have the vision or the foresight to predict it if that's something that's coming.
Well, yeah, we've never seen an independent, even when they start sure. from, you know, start out at the beginning, we've never seen one of them go very far. So, I don't think that'll happen.
Yeah, either.
People talk about it.
Yeah, I don't put much stock. It seems like a good way for people to raise a little bit of money before everything flames out.
Well, and, you know, it's incredible to me that you have these people that say things like, I support Nikki Haley. I don't like President Trump. And they say, if Haley loses, will you support Trump? And they say, yes. You know, and that's the old adage in Democratic politics, you know, that Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line. So do you think the Haley people, do you see them as becoming Trump people, all becoming Trump people, or most of them becoming Trump people?
certainly not all of them, but an exodus like that is always complicated by the fact that the principal always lines up with Trump as well. It's not as though the candidate, I mean, I would be surprised if Nikki Haley didn't line up as you described, just yeah. like Ron DeSantis did, just like Tim Scott did, just like Ted Cruz did, just like, you know, a go down the line of people who have been, you know, insulted and embarrassed by Donald Trump who ended up supporting him. I have no reason to believe that Haley wouldn't in some form or fashion do that same thing. So I certainly think, and I haven't seen enough, or I don't have the polling data memorized to say what percentage of her supporters would, you know, be never, never, ever Trump people. But I'm certain there's a percentage there. But the idea that they're all going to go away, I don't think is realistic. One, just because it's not realistic. And two, because the candidate that they supported is probably in the end going to ultimately endorse Donald Trump, which you yeah. know, complicates things. There complicates what you're speaking to there.
Well, Tim Scott is, he's a Republican, so I guess I understand it. But when I see that Donald Trump has the support of 25% of black people, I'm amazed. I have black friends that support him. And I say to them, do you understand he doesn't like black people? And they're like, oh, no, that's you guys. That's the press. That's all made up. You know, he's really a good guy. And, you know, he has a black man that cuts his lawn and he has a black man that delivers his papers. So he's egalitarian. But yeah, that always surprises me that he has such support in the black community. And I blame that on the Democrats, too. I think that goes back to the thing we talked about before, where black people think that there's a certain amount of black people that think they're ignored by the Democratic Party. And that's really, and please, this is a pet theory of mine, and I'd love to hear your comment on it. But I think that Trump's primary support comes from people that want sabotage. You know, that the word sabotage comes from a French Revolution where workers threw their shoes, their sabots, into the machinery to stop it, right? And that's the way I feel that these Trump supporters see that he is just going to upset everything, and they want that. They want to throw they're so frustrated, they want to throw their shoes into the machine. What do you think? You think reasonable?
I think there's a lot of that. I mean, to go back to your question earlier about how, you know, Trump convinced the voters that support him right. to be so intensely supportive of him. I think there is. Well, I think there's long been a dynamic in American politics of people just saying blow up the system. And I think right. he tapped into that very, very well. And, you know, chaos has always been an occasional byproduct of politics, but the fact that Trump made it the main feature, I think, spoke right. to a lot of people. The people who, you know, just want to shut the whole thing down and remake it, I think that was really, really appealing to them, and he spoke to that very well.
Well, you know, the thing that I find very scary is that I have degrees in political science, so I spent a lot of time as a student, as a graduate student especially, studying the work of Karl Marx. And Karl Marx said, this is inevitable. What we're going through now, that has to happen in a democracy. People following their own self-interest, everybody following their own self-interest, is ultimately doomed to this sort of chaos. So I find that very, very, very scary when I think about it, because I think, you know, I'm very much for democracy, and I really do think we've got a threat here. Well, we're running out of time, Matt, and I appreciate you spending time with us today. What do you want to say? What question haven't I asked you? What do you want to add?
I think the questions are great. I guess the only thing I would add is, you know, Swamp Monsters is on sale anywhere books are sold, from independent sellers all the way up to Amazon. So I would appreciate anyone considering giving it a read.
Yeah, I think you should. And can you get it? Do you have a website or anything that you'd like to give out, or for people to reach out to you, or do
yeah,
you just
well,
need
that-
to go to Amazon?
Well, you can go anywhere where they sell books. We're pretty much everywhere at this point. We did set one up for the book. It's swamp-monsters.com. So just the title of the book with a dash in between it. And there's several background on me in several different places where you can order it there as well. But really, if you have a preferred place that people like to buy books, you can probably go to your favorite locale, and it'll probably be there.
Well, everybody in Washington loves politics and prose, and I know you had a book signing there the other night. How did that go? It's a great little bookstore, is it not?
It was great. They did a wonderful job. Their team was great to work with, and I thought the event went very well. So I was happy to be up there and do it.
Well, I'm going to get my wife right up. My wife's a librarian, so I'm going to task her with getting the book right away. I'd love to read it. I think that you've been a fascinating guest, and I thank you so much for coming. Do you think you'll be in Chicago for the convention?
Yet to be determined. I think there's a decent chance, but I think some of that planning still got to work itself out.
Well, if you're in Chicago, please reach out and let's have lunch, because I would love, or when you're available, I would love to meet you. Do you still live in Florida, I take it?
I do. I live in Tallahassee, Florida, because for the early part of my career, I was focused on covering the Florida legislature and, mm-hmm. and state government here. And we've made it home here. So that's I'm in Florida still.
And you like being down there with all those old people?
I do. Well, there's a lot fewer old people in the northern part of the state. Nobody snowbirds to Tallahassee. But no, I've been in Florida about 15 years now, and I've the state's become home. So I certainly like it here.
Great. Yeah, when I used to travel, I told you before the show, when I used to travel down there, I always went to the places where the old people were. You know, right. I always went to the West Coast and the Southeast.
That's Orlando really, and South.
Yeah, and I never much spent any time in Tallahassee. But again, Matt Dixon, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us. I hope we can talk again maybe later on down the road. And I hope we get a chance to meet in Chicago. Thanks again.
Excellent. Sounds
right.
Good. Thanks for having me.
All right. You know, we usually play a song at the end of the show, and we dedicate it to the person that was on the show. But today we're going to deviate a little bit. There was a lovely, lovely man named Royal Height who wrote a song about D.C. statehood and who was a member of a doo-wop group called the Orioles, who made it into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They have many, many songs that you would remember, songs like Hold Me, Throw Me, Kiss Me, which Gloria Estefan turned into a big hit and was a big hit for them, too, back in the 1950s. But tonight we're going to play a song and we're going to dedicate it to Royal. Sorry about his passing. My condolences go out to his family and friends. He was a great guy. So here's their number one hit of the Orioles. It's Crying in the Chapel. And that's what we'll be doing at your memorial service later today. So rest in peace and thank you. And thank you for listening. And I hope you'll be back next week. And when we hope to have another exciting guest. Thank you.
You saw me crying in the chapel. The tears I shed were tears of joy. I know the meaning of contentment. I am happy. Give the people their right to vote.